Hi, welcome to this week's program. Remember all the hype about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency? If you don't, you can always listen to my previous commentaries, which did a reasonably good job of explaining Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, even if I say so myself. I guess 'tis the season for self-congratulation if you get my drift. But never mind that, moving on. In January 2017, a Bitcoin was trading at about $1,000. Then speculators worldwide got into the game and pushed Bitcoin's market price all the way up to almost $20,000, a 20-fold increase in less than a year. On the way up, some people made boatloads of money, but boy, what a difference a year can make. Today, a year from that near 20,000 high, Bitcoin's market price has dropped about 80% to under 4,000. Those foolish enough to buy near its high or on supposed dips on its way down have lost a lot of money, with little hope of Bitcoin ever recovering. And it's not just Bitcoins. You know, there's a website called Dead Coins that has a long list of cryptocurrency wannabes that tried but failed and don't exist anymore. Actually, 182 listed on that site were scams. 680 are deceased. 12 were outright hacks to deliver malware to your computer, and 60 were parodies like the Lebowski coin and the supercalifragilisticexpialidocious coin. Gee, I wonder who bought into those. But anyway, if you're interested, I've included a chart on Bitcoin's rise and fall on my website, stevepomerantz.com, along with a link to the Dead Coin website. Now, when I look at the Bitcoin chart, I'm reminded of the dot-com boom and bust, where quite a few companies with no revenue whatsoever, highly questionable product strategies, and steep losses traded up to $1 billion valuations based on pure hype. When sentiment turned south, a lot of those valuations turned to smoke, and hundreds of dot-coms went out of business, never to rise again, much like what may happen with Bitcoin. On the flip side, I took a look at the severe crash of October 2007 when stock and real estate valuations tanked because the economy took a nosedive. And I see what happened after March 2009, where stocks and home prices rallied past levels seen before the crash. And I think to myself, the rally after 2009 was almost a given because overly fearful investors had abandoned companies that were intrinsically solid and were bound to bounce back, which they did spectacularly over the next 9 years plus after the market's rally. So how do we make sense of Bitcoin's volatility and what's really behind its sharp fall? To get some insights, I turned to a Forbes article titled "The Cryptocurrency Paradox and Why Crypto is Failing." As the article's author, Jay Atkinson, explains, here is why crypto is falling. Number one, it's not a revenue-producing asset. Even Warren Buffett famously dismissed Bitcoin as an investment in a 2014 interview with CNBC. He compared a Bitcoin transaction to the modern-day equivalent of writing someone a check or sending a money order, and he told investors, stay away from it, it's a mirage, basically. The idea that it has some huge intrinsic value is a joke in my view, end quote. Back then, there were many who thought Buffett simply didn't understand this brave new technology and called him out on it, but the Bitcoin's 80% crash proved that Buffett was right all along. Cryptocurrencies have no intrinsic value. They provide no income stream. They aren't backed by a reliable entity or government. So it's virtually impossible to compute their value other than from supply and demand dynamics. Bitcoin's rise and fall also reminds me of the Dutch tulip mania of 1637. Back then, tulip bulb prices reached extraordinary levels, then crashed. And economists now regard the tulip mania as the first recorded speculative bubble. All right, number two, cryptocurrency is not a commodity. A commodity is like oil or wheat. It's something that is consumed and needs to be replaced with new stock. One could perhaps argue that tulips had some commodity-like value for use in gardens and decorations and such, but cryptocurrency isn't even a commodity. A Bitcoin, for instance, isn't destroyed in a transaction, but can be reused over and over. Number three, it's not a store of value. Just looking at Bitcoin's price chart over the past year illustrates that $1,000 invested in December 2017 is worth $200 today. Clearly, it's not a dependable store of values. Unlike companies which may grow their earnings over time, a Bitcoin produces nothing, so don't expect its value to miraculously increase over time. Simply put, cryptocurrency is a digital currency that can be used to exchange goods and services, and while its underlying blockchain technology appears very promising for a range of secure applications, don't forget that your credit card also represents a purely digital transaction, and that's been around since the 50s, and we know that works. Credit cards, however, deal in local currencies such as the dollar and the euro, whereas cryptocurrencies exchanges involve the currency itself. So if you buy a latte, you pay for it in, say, Bitcoin everywhere across the globe, making it a currency in and of itself. Now, here's another nice thing about credit cards. If your card is stolen, the issuer will make you whole if you report the theft on time. If your Bitcoins get digitally stolen, you have no one you can turn to immediately put your mind at rest. A Japan-based cryptocurrency exchange learned this the hard way when it was hacked and lost $60 million worth of cryptocurrency, including 5,966 Bitcoins. Another thing that makes a cryptocurrency different is that it isn't backed by any central bank or the full faith and credit of any government or even a commodity such as gold. It's completely independent and autonomous across the globe. That, of course, is also part of its appeal, as I noted in my earlier commentaries on Bitcoin, but it also makes it so volatile and completely unreliable. In fact, just last week, I spoke about the hyperinflation of Venezuela's currency. Essentially, Venezuela's government-controlled puppet central bank abandoned fiscal prudence and overprinted bolivars, only to see them drop in value to being almost worthless. That's the bucket that cryptocurrencies fall into, a currency that isn't controlled by any reliable entity with utterly no mechanism to prevent its wild fluctuations in value. In 2017, as Bitcoin rose, many Venezuelans bought it for its perceived independence and as a hedge against inflation. But with Bitcoin down 80% this year, I'm sure a lot of them wish they had bought dollars, euros, or even gold instead of Bitcoins. A cryptocurrency's volatility is also why no sane merchant would want to accept it for their goods and services, because they'd constantly run the risk and headache of watching its value fluctuate wildly. Beyond the hip and cool factor, which coffee merchant would want to deal with repricing its Bitcoin latte prices every single hour? So perhaps you can see why Bitcoin's been no more than a speculative instrument since its inception. And now to the last point. Ironically, in 2017, Bitcoin buyers started hoarding Bitcoin as an investment. If they got their hands on it, they wouldn't let it go. Because there are only a limited number of Bitcoins in circulation, hoarding created a supply-demand imbalance and caused its price to shoot higher and higher. But hoarders missed the point, and hence the paradox. Bitcoin's value lies in its use for transactions. If Bitcoins were actively used and not hoarded, they'd have greater liquidity and merchants would be more likely to accept them as a currency, so they'd gain in value. By not using them for what they were designed, crypto hoarders end up killing the very thing they wanted to see appreciate in value. There's something else that Bitcoin speculators missed. There was nothing unique about Bitcoin. As the list on deadcoins.com shows us, Bitcoin can be easily replaced by any other well-designed cryptocurrency. So hoarding Bitcoins was a fool's errand from the get-go. Looking ahead, the early enthusiasm for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency could have led to its widespread use. Instead, the speculator-driven mania of Bitcoin made people lose interest and set back its adoption. I do believe Bitcoin sparked people's imaginations, so I anticipate seeing some sort of sustainable cryptocurrency emerging in the years ahead. Perhaps something that's backed by an international consortium of trading nations or some such. I also know there's a lot of money going into some very realistic applications of blockchain technology because it offers higher data security than the hackable systems we have in place today. So watch this space for more, and if you want to learn more about Bitcoin, blockchain, or cryptocurrencies' underlying trends, visit my website, stevepomerantz.com, and do a search for Bitcoin to see how many pieces on this fascinating but now somewhat sullied innovation you can find. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. As far as I'm concerned, we are all in the business of selling. As a matter of fact, if you want to get something in this life, you probably have to develop a compelling story in order to get it. You sell to your parents, you sell to your siblings, your teachers, your boss, your significant other. But do we really know how to tell the story that gets the sale? Well, I came across a wonderful book by Matthew Lunn, somebody who has been creating stories for some of the most popular films of the generation. Toy Story, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, Up, Cars, Ratatouille. Matthew Lunn has been sharing story credits on a whole range of films during his 25 years working at Pixar Animation Studios. Yes, Pixar. Obviously, he knows a little something about storytelling. Let's meet him. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for that introduction. I usually just tell people I make them cry for a living, you know, because if anybody out there has seen a Pixar film, yes, I'm one of those story people responsible for making you cry in front of your children and your movie date when you see a Pixar film.
Yeah, listen, I think I cried too, you know, so
yes.
I'm not unashamed. But wasn't it one director, I think, was it Frank Capra, who said he got it wrong when he was making movies? He thought it was about making the actors cry, but it was really about making the audience cry.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think we see that all the time when we're watching a movie or a speaker and we see them start to weep and get emotional, but we're not feeling it.
Yeah.
And then we feel manipulated, right?
Right.
I think there's a lot of truth in that Capra statement. It's about making the audience cry.
You've packed your advice into your new book. The book is The Best Story Wins: How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond. I get the and beyond thing here.
Mm-hmm.
When did you join Pixar?
So I joined Pixar, I was about 21. This was before Toy Story got made. This is when Pixar was still, to be able to make a profit, were animating Gummy Saver commercials and mouthwash commercials.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a few animated shorts that they had made, one with a bouncing lamp and a ball.
Oh, we all know that.
Yeah, that had won an Academy Award.
Right.
And they had the dream of making the very first computer-generated animated film, Toy Story. And I was brought in as one of the first 12 animators on that film.
Wow. Yeah. Was Steve Jobs part of that way back when?
Oh, yeah. You know, Steve, he was pretty much at the beginning. You know, not to bore the listeners out there too much, but the company Pixar was actually created by George Lucas, the guy who created Star Wars. The Pixar department was just a department of about 10 people at George Lucas's studio that were testing out how to use CG animation in special effects.
I see.
Steve Jobs, after he was fired from Apple, wanted to pursue, you know, what else can be done with computers.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard about George Lucas's small group of engineers and artists, and he basically purchased up all of the intellectual property, the employees, and that was the beginning of what we know of as Pixar.
So Steve Jobs himself was a consummate storyteller. You describe in the book how he first introduced the iPhone. Tell us that story quickly.
Sure. So, you know, absolutely. Steve was a great storyteller. And when he pitched the iPhone over 10 years ago, he used the same principles of storytelling that keep you sitting on the edge of your seat wondering what is going to happen next, by having these happy moments and then these kind of low moments in his talk. And how he did that was sharing what was the ordinary world at the time if you were to have a cell phone, a smartphone, and then how it could be extraordinary and happy if you purchased his. And the three points he hit on that made his phone better was that you'll be able to go on the internet on your phone, that you'll be able to use multi-touch to be able to swipe through your phone, and that you would be able to easily install apps.
Mm-hmm.
All things we take for granted now, but at the time they were revolutionary.
Yeah.
And when Steve ended up delivering that pitch, he did the same thing we do in a great movie, which is we take you through these highs and lows, kind of releasing dopamine, then oxytocin, and back and forth. And that's what a great storyteller does.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, we want to translate these ideas to everyday life, right? Because that's the purpose of the book. You're trying to help us understand how to be more convincing, how to get more of what we want through great storytelling. By the way, my guest is Matthew Lunn. The book is The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond. Matthew has worked for Pixar for about 25 years. And also before that, very quickly, you were working on The Simpsons as well as an animator. And that's all in the book. Very interesting how you got started there. So you got an early start if you started at Pixar when you were in your early 20s. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, I started working on The Simpsons when I was 19. I was the youngest animator on the show on the third season.
Incredible. Yeah. So where do you want to start on this? I mean, there's common elements that all good stories share. There are universal story themes and other ways of kind of approaching the idea of building, you know, your story for your product or your service or whatever. Why don't you take it from here and tell us how to do that?
Well, you know, there's many different ways that we can use storytelling in the world of business to be able to make better authentic connections with people and to be able to get people to remember information better, to make it more memorable. So there's going to be times when you want to use those storytelling principles to tell the story around your company, the founder, how you guys started. Or there might be a time when you want to share a story around yourself, you know, something that you experienced that taught you about teamwork or innovation. I think the most common way that we use storytelling in business is through metaphors. You know, I think we all know the challenge of wanting to share information that may be too analytical and people don't get it. Or if we're on the receiving end and we're at a keynote or a PowerPoint presentation, and someone is talking to us for, oh gosh, who knows how many hours, and it's so analytical and so dry that we're just left remembering nothing. We're not impacted at all.
Yeah.
And so when you use storytelling, you can make information more memorable. You can make it more impactful and you can make it more personal.
So give me an example of that.
Sure. So, you know, when Toy Story came out, it was the highest grossing movie in 1995. This blew us all away at Pixar. But at our very next company meeting, when Steve Jobs, the owner of Pixar, came up on stage and everyone was so hyped up and excited, Steve asked if anybody had any questions. Now, remember, Pixar was full of artists, engineers, technical people, managers, and people had a lot of questions. And the questions were things like, are we going to make a live action film at Pixar? Are we going to make video games? Are we going to make a TV show? Everybody wanted to immediately just go from one animated film to doing everything. And at this point, this is really what makes Steve and a great storyteller stand out, is Steve could have then pulled out a chart, pulled out a whiteboard, and started explaining to everybody how over-leveraging is bad when you've just started a company and you're just new and you've had just one success. But he didn't, because he knew the audience and he knew it was probably going to bore us. So instead, he shared a metaphor, a story. And the story started off where Steve shared that when he used to work at the Apple company before he was fired, that he used to go to the same sandwich shop every day that was run by a husband and wife in Silicon Valley, because he loved the sandwiches and everybody in the area loved the sandwiches. They would wait 45 minutes to get a sandwich, gobble it down, and then zip back to work. And then one day Steve came into the sandwich shop, still ran by just the husband and wife, and he saw that they had leased the building to the right and left of them, that they had also opened up a bakery and a coffee shop while still running the sandwich shop. And Steve went to get his sandwich, waited in a long line, and the sandwich didn't taste so great. And then he went to the coffee shop. The coffee was mediocre. Then he went to the bake shop, and it wasn't good either. And so Steve just, next time he was going to, for lunch, he just didn't go. And then a couple of months later, when he drove by the three buildings, they were all out of business.
the lesson of the story, the moral is...
Exactly. The moral of the story is don't over leverage when you are just starting off.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody in the audience at Pixar, artists, engineers, technical people, no matter how analytical they were or how abstract they were, everybody understood the lesson because of the story. And, you know, how many times do you talk to your blue in the face trying to convince people of the facts and the figures? But there's a power in storytelling where everybody gets it.
We're going to be back with Matthew Lunn, the author of The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond, and find out more about the power of storytelling. Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. I'm back with Matthew Lunn. Matthew is the author of the new book, The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond. Matthew Lunn spent 25 years with Pixar Animation Studios, and he's back to talk about how to improve your storytelling to get what you want. Welcome back to the show, Matthew.
Okay. How you doing?
Good. So, you know, in the book, you describe something that you call the story spine.
Yes.
And you explained it pretty well. Would you take us through that, please?
Sure. You know, the story spine, I first heard of the story spine when I was taking improv classes. And when I started the improv class at Pixar called The Improbables, I started using the story spine. And the reason why we would use it in improv is because it was a simple exercise that prompted you to have a story with a beginning, middle, and an end, and you can make it up by the seat of your pants, and you would still have a story.
Okay.
And I started seeing that the story spine, which is so familiar to us, it goes like this. Once upon a time, and every day, until one day, and because of that, because of that, because of that, until finally, since that day. Mm. And those prompts, you fill in the rest of the beginning of that sentence.
Right.
And, you know, we would do this in improv, it'd be fun. But then I started to realize that those same steps in the story spine are act one, act two, and act three in a film.
Yeah.
You know, the steps that we use, the story structure steps that we use to make a film and that have been used in storytelling for many years, follow that same story spine. Let me give you an example. For example, the movie Finding Nemo. Mm-hmm. If there's anybody out there who's seen that movie, hopefully.
Yeah.
But once upon a time, there was a father fish that had just gotten married. He's going to have a bunch of kids. He's so excited. And they just got a new sea anemone house, great view of the ocean. And a barracuda attacks, kills his wife, all of his babies, except for one, who's left with a damaged fin. So I've just done the once upon a time.
Okay.
And every day, years later, this father, being he just lost his entire family, is so overprotective to protect his one last child, Nemo. He protects him so much, he won't let him go to school or play with his other friends. And then we hit the third part. Until one day, Nemo defies his dad, swims to the top of the ocean, and gets fishnapped by a scuba diver. So you can see I just did the three parts. And then when you get to the and because of that, now you're in act two. And because of that, the father, this overprotective father, he ends up heading out to rescue his son with the help of a fish with a very bad memory. And that, he ends up facing sharks and anglerfish and all kinds of dangerous things in the ocean. And because of that, he finds his son in Sydney in a dentist's office and sees that his son is dead in a plastic bag.
Mm-hmm.
And we as the audience know Nemo is pretending he's dead to get flushed down the toilet to get to the ocean. But dad, he thinks that he's responsible. He caused this.
Right.
And till finally, the dad ends up, you know, just not even wanting to live anymore. But his friend Dory ends up telling him Nemo is not dead. He was just playing dead. But he's in the net and he's caught. We need to help. And that's when we find them all get caught in the net. And Nemo is the only one who knows how to escape. And dad needs to trust him. He does. And since that day, now they're back home. The father ends up letting Nemo go to school. Nemo's happy. He's immersed with the other kids. And Dory, the secondary character, she has a home now. So I told you the whole story in like about a minute.
Right, right.
With this story spine. And it's what the story spine is so great about is it keeps things simple. It's when we tell stories, how often do we ramble?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I love my mom, but boy, when she would tell me a story, once she'd hit act two, it could go on for who knows how long. And I'd just be all, Mom, get to the point.
Okay. So hang on, Matthew. So let me try here.
Okay.
Because I read the book and I started to think about it. So my own career and the radio show and all of that basically started when I decided that no longer did I want to continue to do business, the stock brokerage business, the way it existed 20, 25 years ago. And I needed a change. So that was the once upon a time. There was this young man who didn't like the way things were.
Mm.
And every day I would go to work and I would be very unhappy and I would see that clients were really not being served the way I thought they should. The accent was on the wrong thing. It was on the company making money, not the clients making money. Until one day I got an opportunity to change because the company I worked for decided to close their division outside of New York. And they said, take your clients with you. And I had a choice to either go back to the brokerage industry or to start my own company, which I did the latter. And because of that, I was able to develop a company that served clients first, that did not have conflicts of interest with regards to compensation. And I was able to develop a radio show to further those ideas and to communicate those ideas. Until finally, well, the story is still has to be told, but finally the business became extremely successful. And since that day, clients and myself have been happy campers. How did I do?
That was awesome. You know, one of the things that I always love is that, you know, when you hit that until one day, that's the part of the story where the journey can begin for the hero or they can quit. So at that point, when the business was, you know, said, we're closing up shop, you can take your clients and leave, you could have said, I quit.
Yeah,
I'm not going to do anything anymore. And that's when a story dies. But a story ends up really heading forward when the hero decides to take that good or bad thing that's come to their life and set off on a journey to do something new.
To do something
new. And that's what you did.
Yeah, the incentive to change has to be a force in the story. Now, you say, we don't have a lot of time, but you say there are six universal story themes, and I'm going to read through them, and I want you to pick one or two.
Okay.
Love and belonging, safety and security, power and responsibility, fun and playfulness, and awareness and understanding. Take one of those.
Sure, sure.
And give us an idea of the story built around it.
So those universal themes, whenever you want to connect with a lot of people, like a Pixar film, you want to use a universal theme that people can relate to. This is why, if you don't do this, you get a film that just doesn't connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think of a film like WALL-E, usually, you know, not everybody can connect with a sci-fi film. Star Wars obviously was very successful, but usually a sci-fi space kind of film doesn't always land with everybody. But WALL-E did, and it's because the universal theme is about the last robot on Earth that wants to fall in love. And that is something we can all relate to. We have all, hopefully at this point, have had our first kiss. We've all experienced love. We've also experienced what it feels like to have our heart broken.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever you want to connect, you know, you've got to do a talk. You need to do a presentation in front of a lot of people. Think about something that they can all relate to.
Yeah.
Maybe it's about being a parent or being a kid and what it's like when you want safety and security for your family. I mean, isn't that a great place to jump off from for anybody in the health insurance company or the financial institution about safety and security through health or finances? So now all of a sudden, you're sharing a principle that's, you know, something that's important to your company, but you're using a universal theme that makes it human. Yeah. It makes it relatable, you know?
Beautiful, beautiful ideas. The book is The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond. My guest is Matthew Lunn, former animator for Pixar. Now you're keynote speaker, quite active in that area.
Yep.
Are you working on any other animation projects?
Yeah, so I just finished working as a writer on an animated film that's coming out soon. And then I'm working as a writer and a producer on another animated film that's getting pitched around in Hollywood right now.
Great.
So what I enjoy to do, you know, artist as a writer, I need to keep creating. Yeah. I need to keep writing. I need to keep drawing. I need to keep making things. But the thing I love to do is the people in the business world, how often do they get somebody from the film world or the entertainment world to share the secrets of making great stories, you know? And so I love to do that.
Your specialty is storytelling. And as I said in the opening of the segment, it's life and getting what you want is all about storytelling. As a matter of fact, if you have a question about what we just discussed and want to hear some more stories to tell and other segments to hear, you've got a money issue on your mind, don't forget to join the conversation by joining us through our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for a weekly update where we'll give you a rundown of everything that we've been doing for that previous week, including Matthew's segment will be on there as well. And we'll have all the links for Matthew. And as a matter of fact, you can also get to Matthew at Matthew Lunn, that's L-U-H-N, MatthewLunnStory.com. Hey, Matthew, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry's a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So, you know, from time to time, actually week to week, we do something called the Real Estate Survival Guide, which happens to be my favorite segment.
Yep.
And we usually use the questions and answers that are answered by Gary Singer from the Sun Sentinel. And we're doing that again today. So here's a question. Can a landlord kick a tenant out in 30 days? Let me read it. I have been renting my apartment for 6 years using annual leases. This year at renewal time, I asked to go on a month-to-month lease due to some maintenance concerns. The landlord agreed. We signed a month-to-month agreement that calls for a 30-day notice to terminate the lease. I just received a notice that the landlord wants me out in 30 days. I pay my rent at the beginning of each month, but the letter says they want me out in the middle of next month. Can he do this? And by the way, I always pay on time and the landlord has no reason to kick me out other than not wanting me to sign an annual lease. Is this okay?
Aha. So leases are contracts, right?
That's right.
And landlords and tenants have to abide by what the contract says. So in this particular case, you've switched to a month to month. Now your month starts in the beginning of the month. Mm-hmm. So technically, to answer that question, he can't just cut you out in the middle. He has to give you 30 days from the beginning of the month.
Yeah. So let's say it's the middle of the month and he sends you this notice. He's going, I want you out in 30 days, which is the middle of the next month.
Correct.
According to this, that really can't work that way because you're on a month-to-month lease. So it has to go to the following, the end of the month.
Correct. So, but here's what's important. And you see a lot of people do this month-to-month. The law, and you can make whatever rules you want when you do a lease, but generally, typically, when it is a month-to-month, because I get this question all the time, how much notice do I have to give if I am on a month-to-month? Yeah. And the law says 15 days.
Okay. So, yeah, in this particular case, it's said in the contract.
Correct. They had agreed 30 to 30. Days, you could agree to whatever you want, but a lot of people don't know the answer to that question. That is the legal answer.
Yeah. As a person not in the real estate business, here's how I took this. She was concerned about some maintenance issues. Something, he wasn't fixing something.
Right.
So she's like, you know what? I'm putting you on notice that this great renter that you have is so concerned we're going month to month. Okay. And then you think, you know, well, be careful what you wish for.
That's right.
Because he's turning around going, you know what? Hey, this may be a good thing.
This is an opportunity.
It's an opportunity for me to raise, get somebody else in and raise rents.
That's right.
You know, that doesn't really know that these problems.
She didn't play this card well.
Not really. Not really. It was kind of a bit of a surprise. What do you mean?
Yeah.
You know?
What?
So
I'm a good person.
Exactly.
It's all about the money. I'm sorry.
Well, of course it is. Of course it is. All right. Changing gears here. One very interesting article I saw from an interview with a Palm Beach real estate agent says that she's surprised that there's a lot of requests from her multimillionaire clients for downsizing.
That doesn't surprise me.
Why?
Because I'm seeing that in my own market. Mm-hmm. You know, these sellers, owners of these large properties don't want these large properties anymore. They want quality over quantity. And a lot of these people have multiple homes.
Yeah.
So it's really not a matter of they own a big house in New York, they come down here. They don't necessarily want that big, big house
anymore.
It's
like they have to run a corporation again. It's very complicated. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of people to hire, to worry about, you know, paying properly. Are they doing their job? You have to monitor. It's a big deal. And people, I guess, don't really want to do that anymore.
Right. They're looking for simplicity. Less is more. I say it all the time. Yeah, Less is more.
In this article, they talk about many of them are going to these extended stay
hotel type
things. So in this article, it said for $4,000 a month, which you and me seem kind of low.
Right.
For $4,000 a month, you get a lot of luxury entitlements. For example, what? You get dog walking and fitness center.
Valet parking, room service.
They give you all the silverware that you need and everything that you do. You know, I mean, it's just stock. You get personal trainers, weekly housekeeping, and a whole kind of comes in, which is that lifestyle.
It's attractive.
I think.
I don't know. I've never stayed at a luxury extended stay hotel. Have you?
Well, I haven't. In Los Angeles, a 3-tower development will feature, it's going to happen, a 2-acre sky park with 2 dog parks, a basketball court, lawns, a swimming pool, and a running track. In Baltimore, there's also an al fresco dining space, yoga and meditation room, and business lounge. So
I'm glad they're thinking about the dogs.
Let's talk about the market for 2019. We've been kind of in a seller's market, mostly, really, since the crash, right?
Yep, absolutely.
The Great Recession, as they call it.
Right.
And in the early part of that, it was difficult to get a mortgage. And then after a while, the sellers didn't want to sell anymore because those that did get a mortgage locked into some really attractive rates. They didn't want to have to flip that over. Plus, they're liking what they bought.
Right.
So it's been a seller's market. But you're seeing more inventory come into your world.
That's right.
You know, we spoke about the fact that you normally have about 12 to 14 listings, and now you've got like 25 listings. So there's more sellers out there, at least in your
little micro world,
right?
Right.
And if that happens, then are we moving to a buyer's market in 2019? What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are we are changing gears.
Like transitioning.
Transitioning. I don't want to say it's going to be a buyer's market in 2019. I'm not ready to declare that.
Okay.
It takes some time. It is transitioning. I will say that it all depends on which market you're talking about. And a lot of it's price point. So in our market down here, $1 million is luxury. Mm-hmm. And in the market above $1 million, we're seeing very much a buyer's market. In the median price range, we're seeing a balanced market. And then the lower price property, we're very much seeing it still as a seller's market. Mm-hmm. So the rate of growth is retracting the amount of appreciation.
Right.
And the inventory is climbing, which is great news, very healthy for our real estate market. We need more inventory.
Yeah. So it's all good.
So it's good.
It's not good to have a market that continually increases in price, whether it's a stock market, the bond market, Bitcoin or whatever it is, you know. It's indicative of speculation and the wrong people being in there. We call it, you know, buying with weak hands.
Right. Now, this isn't information to tell you if you're a buyer, I'm going to sit and wait. Don't sit on the sidelines because you are going
to
lose
out. No, you need to buy. When you're ready to buy a house you live in, a house you just have to buy, buy the right one. And also interest rates have kind of stopped rising at this point.
Correct.
They come down actually a little bit. So it's making it a little more attractive now that there's more inventory. This is all really
good
news.
This is a good time to get back out there.
When is the best time to buy real estate?
Right now.
And when is the best time to sell?
Right now.
You know, you surprise me every time you say that. My guest, Terry Story, 30-year veteran Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Ron Shaich is the founder of Panera Bread, having taken this company from a 400-square-foot store to a restaurant brand that has more than 2,400 bakery cafes, over 120,000 employees, and nearly $6 billion in annual sales. The result? Panera was the best-performing restaurant stock for the past 20 years, delivering a total shareholder return 44 times better than the S&P 500 from 1997 to 2017. Ron has now turned his attention to fixing some of the corporate weakness that he sees that may be causing unintentional damage to our country. Let's find out more. Welcome, Ron Shaich. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for taking your time. I really appreciate it.
Good.
The restaurant business isn't easy, you've been quoted as saying. You know, the business is like dirt farming. The world doesn't need another restaurant. You need to be crystal clear about what you're focusing on. Going back a ways, did you have a big picture when you started Panera so many years ago, or did it develop over time?
I think it's continued to develop over the 36 years I ran our company and the 26 years I ran a public company. Mm-hmm. The reality is that unless you're able to deliver a total experience that is materially better than other competitive alternatives, unless you're able to provide an experience that customers walk past your competitors to come to you, mm-hmm. you don't win here.
Yeah.
And this is a very difficult industry. 9 out of 10 restaurants go out of business. You need to deliver for the guest in a profound way. And that's always been the focus.
Well, you know, you also were around and starting to develop this at the beginning of what turned out to be a $40 billion segment of the restaurant industry, this good quality food, fast casual, as they say. So I guess the trend was your friend as well, but you saw pretty far ahead and you took the actions to take advantage of those trends. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I believe the most fundamental role of a CEO is to sit back, understand what's going on, discover today what's going to matter tomorrow, and make sure my organization is there as that future unfolds. Mm-hmm. And you don't need me to tell you what they did yesterday. You don't need me to tell you what my competitors are doing. You need me to lead this organization into the future. And so we've had a continual history of that. Panera has existed for 36 years as a company. It was originally a French bakery. And we took that French bakery and converted it into a French bakery cafe. Mm-hmm. We let the croissant and bread no longer be the product, but a platform to sell soup salad and sandwiches.
Yeah.
And then I can remember in the mid-90s, it was very clear to me as I traveled the country and I listened, I tried to listen with empathy to our guests. And you'd hear, I don't know, 1 out of 3, 1 out of 4 consumers complaining about fast food.
Yeah.
And they'd say, I want something better. And you know, just listening, you could see they wanted real food. They wanted environments that engaged them. They wanted people that cared. They wanted environments that actually, as currency, gave them a sense of self-respect. And so for us, we began to build Panera around that kind of model.
Mm-hmm.
Later, that became, people began to call that fast casual. We led the way.
Yeah.
My friend Howard Schultz at Starbucks followed, the folks at Chipotle later. But it was really about seeing there was a niche, and there always are niches, within fast food that offered an extraordinary opportunity for us. And today, that's a $50 billion business.
You decided to take Panera public, and that was to raise capital to fund your expansion, kind of a typical story there. However, in 2007 and 2000...
And I will add for your listeners what happens to so many companies, to give liquidity to some of our investors.
Ah, of course. Oh, good point. Right. Unfortunately, though, in 2007 and 2015, you ran into significant challenges from activist investors. really in the form of hedge funds. And that shaped the course of business from that point forward. Tell us quickly about that and what direction it led you.
Well, Steve, most of the kinds of transformations that led to this, you know, led us to beat the S&P 500 by 44-fold, what led us to deliver 25% annual returns annually over the last two decades, was about 5 and 6 year transformation efforts and really betting on a way we would go to market. And the truth of the matter is, when you're going through that, nothing's proven, and nothing's proven until it's done. Quick story, I can remember when we made that bet on fast casual and this new vision. Everybody would say to me, all there is fast food and fine dining. And people would say to me, Ron, this isn't going to work. Well, now, you know, 30 years later, people say to me, Ron, why didn't you tell me about it? Yeah. And I look at them and I go, I was telling you. Uh-huh. Nobody wanted to listen.
They didn't want to listen.
You could have bought my stock by the wheelbarrow for one penny on the dollar of what it eventually traded for. But nobody wanted to listen then. And my point is, again, nothing's proven until it's done. The most important thing is to understand it takes a leap of faith to move into the future. And what I have found is each time I've taken this company through transformation, in the end, it worked. Everybody got excited. But when I was going through it, there were folks that really wanted to short-term the company. And I can remember in 2015, it didn't take very much. We were investing in technology as part of a program to offer digital alternatives, to offer clean food, to improve the loyalty program, to ultimately position Panera as the best competitive alternative. All those things became the themes of the restaurant industry by 2017 and led Panera to have a phenomenal 2017, led the industry in what are called same-store sales. But in 2015, we were spending, at that time, $50 million a year to build that. And it doesn't take any skill to walk in the door and say, hey, I bought 1% of your company in stock. I got another 7 or 8% in options. I'm now the owner. You know, you work for me. I need you to cut the G&A by a third. I need you to wipe out all this technology investment. And you know what? You can dip in and out whatever the cash flow is to your investors. We'll sell out at that point and somebody else can worry about the carcass. The truth in a matter, it doesn't take much to press for the short term. And straight up, as somebody who's run a public company for 26 years, I could always short term it.
Yeah.
But if, as a large shareholder, what I want and what I believe shareholders deserve are management teams that are willing to look beyond the next quarter or even the next year and do the hard work of leading and managing, which is figuring out what's going to matter tomorrow and then get this company to deliver on that.
I'm speaking with Ron Shaich, the founder of Panera Bread, and we're going through his experiences and what he's learned and what he's trying to basically tell us about what's going on in business today and with some fixes, because he's not just talking about it, he's actually actively working to change things. So it's this pressure or this tension between short-termism, which is what did you do this quarter? You know, how are the profits looking? And if profits are weak, then we'll take your stock outside and shoot it, even though, you know, the business seems to be building and so on.
Not only if your profits are weak, if you're investing, we're going to question every investment
you make. Yeah, because that's easy. As you said, it's easy to go in there and say, well, let's take out this $15 million and look what's left over. And that'll pump the price of the stock up. And then as an activist investor, I can go in and sell it. And then I'm in and I'm out. And then what do you really have left in the business is the question. And that's what you're basically saying. So the short-term thinking versus long-term thinking. But now there's starting to be a backlash. And I think you're on the vanguard of this backlash. I mean, we've started to see some companies say, well, we're not really going to report certain things every single quarter. We're not going to get caught up in the minutiae of, you know, what exactly we're doing and trying to focus more on the long term. However, it seems to me that that's going to be quite an uphill battle. What do you think?
Well, Steve, I think the first step is for your listeners, for the citizens of our country to understand how this has happened and how it doesn't serve us. The reality is 40 years ago, the average shareholder held a stock for 8 years. At this point, they're renting that stock for 8 months. There's a lot of reasons that's happened. You have hedge funds that are increasingly trading on the next inflection point. What are the comp store sales next quarter?
Right. Sure.
You have money managers, active money managers that are themselves intended on short-term results. So they're pressing for short-term results. You have the prevalence of index funds that are essentially outsourcing corporate governance to ISS and Glass Lewis, which are outside consulting firms. All of this is magnified by what's called flash trading, algorithm-based trading, mathematical-based trading, which increases the volatility.
Yeah.
All of this leads to an environment in which activists are fostered. The restaurant industry had approximately 20% of their public companies attacked by activists last year.
Mm-hmm.
If we really think one in five of our management teams are so bad that they need to be run by somebody who's got a financial engineering playbook based in some office tower in New York, we've got bigger problems. And here's the point and why I raise it. Our public markets are fundamentally broken. People don't want to raise money in the public markets at this point. You've got less companies going public last year than you had going public at the height of the recession.
Mm.
That's a big problem.
Yeah,
that's a serious problem. Long-term money has increasingly become...
Why is
that
a problem?
Let's get to it. Long-term money has increasingly become private, not public. The reason it's an intensely challenging product problem for the society is our public companies are going to go away. Small investors are not going to have an opportunity to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And large investors through private equity will.
The
reason it's a problem is because if we want real GDP growth, that's what we all talk about.
Right.
In my view, it doesn't just happen through a sugar high tax cut.
Yeah.
The only way people believe GDP growth occurs is through productivity increases and innovation. If you want productivity and you want innovation, you need to make long-term commitments. You need to make long-term bets. If you're only thinking quarter to quarter, the only kind of investment you make, the only kind of ROI you focus on is cost cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what we want, that's what we're going to end up with.
Okay.
And the challenge is most people don't understand. It's our system. It's our country. We've got to ask ourselves, is this really serving us? And if it isn't serving us, we've got to challenge ourselves to do better. And there are real structural mechanisms to do better.
Okay, let's discuss one of these that is actually quite new to me. It's called the long-term stock exchange. Are you involved in this? Do you know about it? Do you have a comment on that?
I am not involved in it, but I do have a comment about it. I think that there's a number of people that are searching for answers to this. Jamie Dimon has written about it. Warren Buffett has written about it. They've called for a change in the way guidance works. You've heard President Trump himself really challenge quarterly earnings reports.
Mm-hmm.
You have Larry Fink of Blackstone, one of the largest investors in the world, speak to this. You have many academics speaking to this problem. My fundamental view is that we need to first address this problem by being aware of it. And then secondly, there needs to be structural remedies. We have the potential, as there are in other countries in the world, to have differential voting rights based on how long you hold the stock. So somebody who's held the stock for 20 minutes
mm-hmm.
shouldn't have the same influence as those folks that have held it for 10 years.
Okay.
There are other ways to get there, but effectively it's differential voting rights. Secondly, our compensation systems need to be focused much more on long-term results. This world in which compensation is highly focused on short-term is getting us as a society and as an economy the wrong answers.
Mm-hmm.
And then third, very importantly, we've got to be thinking about the nature of guidance. I don't have a problem with reporting quarterly.
Yeah.
I actually have much more of a problem with reporting and providing guidance, which by its very nature forces the whole discussion, not about the growth of the company, but how do you perform against the guidance?
Well, okay, hold on a second. For those who don't know, when you're talking about guidance, what does that actually mean?
Well, public companies are guiding investors relative to future performance.
So they're saying, this is what we think we're going to do next year or next quarter, that type of thing?
Yes. Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say this to your listeners and to you, Steve. And it's not that difficult, right? The most successful companies in the market are what are called the FANG companies, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. What do they have in common? What they have in common is the ability to have a long-term capital structure. You know, it's like so many other things. I have a son who's 19 years old. He's in college, freshman at WashU in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he wanted to go out and party for the next month, he could have a great time. But I don't want to encourage him to do that. I want him to make an investment in his education. I want him to make an investment, frankly, through exercise in himself.
Mm-hmm.
I want him to take care of himself because I want him to think long-term.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any different for our companies. And we've created a system that puts intense pressure on the short term, puts our boards and our management in a position where they get very myopic. Why? They're not bad people. They want to please. They want to win.
Yeah.
They feel a sense of vulnerability. So what did they do? They go short term to provide what is essentially asked of them. And the problem is, we as an economy suffer. The very things that drive that long-term growth in the FANG companies are off the table in those kind of companies. And truthfully, for me, we built Panera up into a multi-billion dollar company. Again, the most successful in the restaurant industry. I chose to take it private, to sell it into the private marketplace, because I profoundly worried, as a man of 65 years, how would Panera keep driving what drove its competitive advantage, its ability to make transformative changes? How would we do that 5 and 10 and 20 years in the future if it didn't have my credibility and it didn't have the 17% of the company that I voted? That's the challenge.
All right. My guest, Ron Shaik. Ron, do you blog? Is there any way people can follow you to go along with you and see what you're thinking?
They can follow me. I have my own website, ronshaik.com, ronshaik.com. They can get to me through that.
Okay.
Good. They can Google me. And I also have a couple hundred thousand followers on LinkedIn. So if they're on LinkedIn, feel free to reach out to me.
Very good.
Ron Shaik, R-O-N-S-H-A-I-C.
S-H-A-I-C-H is the spelling of the last name. And of course, if you've been listening, you know that Ron is the founder of Panera Bread and so many other things. Ron, we are out of time. I need another hour with you, quite frankly, but time won't allow. So thank you very much. And listeners, if you have a question about what we've just discussed or you want to get a discussion going on this, we would love to have some back and forth. If you've got a money issue in your mind, join the conversation and contact us through our website at stevepomerantz.com. Ron, one more time, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, listeners.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.